This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Ik. As children, we learn that touch is one of our five physical senses that we use to interact with our environment. But touch also plays an important role in our emotional and mental well-being. So I'm going to explore that today with my guest, clinical psychologist Paul Jamunathan and psychologist Dr. Goh Pei Hua. And, discuss the importance of touch. What happens when we are deprived of touch? Do we even recognize when that may be happening to us? And how do we look at, pardon the pun, embracing more touch in our lives? How do we identify the need if there is indeed a lack of? Paul and Pei Hua, how are you today?
Hello.
I am touched by your introduction. That's nice.
So that's interesting, isn't it? That's a metaphorical use of the word touch.
Yeah,
is it though?
Yeah, they basically...
the
literature is very limited in this area because of the ethics behind research into touch. Mm. But yes, you have a sensory aspect of touch and you have this metaphorical or metaphysical aspect of touch when you say, I'm touched by what you said or things like that. But yes, it's the science of haptics.
So I guess what we are familiar with is the sensory aspects.
Yes.
I don't know, Paul, is there a definition of what we mean by touch, right? Is it what we know in that physical sense?
Yeah.
What is the cognitive connection? What is that metaphysical connection,
Okay, that's another show. But there is a particular definition according to the psychology definitions in the computers. It's defined as, it's sense recognized by the tactile organs or neural receptors in the skin, as well as in the tongue, throat, mucosa, your tissue and things like that. But, there's actually a specific brain pathway that's involved. But this is the definition. It's a sense recognized. And thus, that Pei Hua is here today because she's one of her areas of expertise is perception and how people send and receive messages and things. And she's a social psychologist. So there's a lot of touching going on in that area as well. But the definition basically is, it's a sense recognized by tactile organs or receptors. Now, I lost touch totally waist down after I broke my back many, many, many years ago. And I thought I was a broken man till the nerves were repaired and the senses of touch came back. But yes, there are organs that are specific to touch. And you won't believe where those organs are situated. The place it's called is the suborbital cortical area, right behind your orbital area behind your eye, and then it moves on to other parts of the brain. It's a tiny part of the brain, but they call it the nexus of all things like judgment, integration of so many other things. Touch is such an important bit that it feeds into a junction that sends information to so many parts of the brain that deals with perception, judgment, and so many other things like violence, aggression, love, sex, behavior, anything, man. So that's my definition, but the social psychologist, I don't know.
Yeah, but do you want to take it beyond that, just that pure, narrow
touch?
Sense? Oh dear.
Okay, well, you talked about, actually that definition was extremely comprehensive and he even touched on the brain. Pun intended. In social psychology, we focus a bit more, or at least in my area, I focus on affiliative touch. So how do you touch to show people that you're trying to, connect with them, show them some warmth, and to make them feel like they're liked?
That's a big area, man.
Yeah, but, isn't touch just that, right? It's an objective action. You touch somebody. How do you go into affiliative? How do you communicate a particular emotion or desire for something just through touch?
I know. It's fascinating, isn't it? So when I was looking at, touch, because, there are things that we learned in biology ages ago. And I was like, I remember learning about receptors. So I was like, okay, let me quickly look that up. So there are four receptors. There's one that senses light touch, one that senses temperature, so hot or cold, pain, and pressure.
Yeah.
And I want you to imagine touch, being touched by someone who cares about you, you know, when they're trying to console you. How does that touch feel like?
Usually gentle.
Gentle.
For pain and hot or not?
No, I don't think so.
But maybe you feel some warmth, right? Because if you imagine that touch, it's slow.
Right.
And you, there's more surface area that you feel. And because it's gentle and it's like a bit, it stays there a bit longer, you feel some warmth.
I see.
As opposed to...
You call it a warm touch.
A warm touch, yeah. As opposed to when someone taps you like that. You feel pressure, a bit of pain, no warmth, small surface area. So you can see, even just looking at the basics of the biology, there's a difference there.
Absolutely. So do the different kinds of touch go to different pathways in the brain and cause the brain to respond differently?
Not a complete expert in that area because I'm not a neuroscientist. But what I do know is that there are some parts of your brain that's specialized in recognizing emotional touch or touch that's more affiliative in nature. So there are special parts there. And I think you need to think about the implication of that. When your body takes effort to actually specialize for something, you know it must be important for human survival.
And I want to talk a little bit, Paul, about how an individual develops that those pathways and that part of the brain to specialize. Because
you're born with it.
Are you born with it?
It's already happening in, inside before you're born.
But are there, you know, phases as you go through life, especially in infancy, where there are opportunities to nurture that, or it could be, I don't know, disrupted somehow?
There are several important questions there, Xiaoying. The first thing is, touch is actually one of the first senses that develops because the neural system is so integrated in what a fetus, okay? And you're being touched by the womb. And the womb responds, and the mother responds to the touch, the movement of the baby. It's all sensorial. But when the baby is delivered, the next survival instinct kicks in. And so what a lot of people say is the first sense that develops is the sense of smell. Well, of course, now you're out in the world and you smell something other than amniotic fluid. And so that kicks in. And then you start thinking, hey, I'm beginning to see shades of light. So the eyes kick in. But touch, then it takes a secondary or tertiary level and it just gets down the pecking order. But the largest sense known and the most important sense is touch, because when they worked with handicapped people and people who are sensorily deprived, some papers have described that how people choose what kind of sense they want to lose first. If they were given a choice, would I go blind first? Would I lose my sense of smell first? And funnily enough, a lot of people say, I'd rather lose my sense of touch last. I really need the sense of touch. Because with the sense of touch, you can make a lot of sense of the world with the memory of smells and other things. The other question you asked me, what was that?
Well, I'm thinking about how they encourage skin-on-skin contact, right? Mm. The moment a baby is born. Is that part of helping
the
to
way
develop?
The way that the neural system is developed according to this, the nexus, as we call it, the junction of touch, when you're touched, a lot of nerves, this is just a child, a baby, infant, all your information goes into various parts of that little cortex, that part of the brain, and then it sends it to other parts of the brain that are specialized, like Peihua mentioned just now. But as a little baby, not all are specialized. All your perceptions aren't specialized. All your smells aren't localized or you know, the safe zones and dangerous zones. But it still senses that perception. So if you're touched wrongly, or if you're always touched in a specific way, you get used to that kind of that touch, and those pathways in later life burn. I mean, they become burnt pathways, and that's how sometimes they become pathological. Now.
So what could happen during infancy and a child's formative years that could go wrong?
Lack of touch, that's why research now says is, don't take the baby, swaddle it, quickly give it a cold bath, and then, you know, a cold bottle of milk. No. Straight away on the mother's skin to skin. Touch immediately. Famous research when I was a student in Sheffield Children's Hospital, babies who were touched got better and cured faster and got discharged faster than another ward, which is run by a matron who encouraged the nurses not to touch and not to play.
Pei Hua, was there anything that you wanted to add? You know, when we're talking about this the period of infancy and formative upbringing.
Yeah, so I think one thing that Paul mentioned that's really important is how we don't realize that we're touching something at every single moment. So if you're a listener, I want you to ask yourself, what are you touching right now? If you're driving, okay, you have your hands on the steering wheel. But if you're walking and you maybe are listening to this through headphones, are you touching something at this moment? You probably first think, no, my hands are, I'm just walking. I'm not touching anything.
It's not about proprioception. It's not where they are, but what are you touching and feeling?
What are you touching and feeling, right? So right now I'm sitting here, I'm holding a pen. Sure, I'm touching my pen, but my butt is against the chair. Mm. So I'm feeling something and we're probably clothed all the time, right? So you, hopefully, right? So you would feel your clothes against you as well. And I want you to also think about how you didn't notice all of these until I mentioned it. Mm. And it's because we are being touched all this time, you know, by different things that we have to kind of shut that off. Because if not, our brains will just explode with all this information.
Yeah, sensory overload.
Yeah. Mm. So it is a very important sense that we don't constantly think about. But jumping back to the, you know, being touched as a child and how does that affect you? And what Paul said was actually found in other, not just, Sheffield, right, you mentioned?
That's my student days early 80s.
Yeah, not just there, but also like I've read some studies, old studies that show like, you know, babies that were touched more tend to be more free of mental health issues.
True.
They connect better with people.
Absolutely.
And yeah, generally life outcomes are better.
They're more responsive.
I mean, it does seem very intuitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when we're talking about touching babies more, one might argue, yeah, we carry them in order to feed them the bottle, perhaps, right? Or to breastfeed. We touch them when we change their diapers and bathe them and all of that. Are we talking about touch that goes beyond these basic needs as well?
Okay, this is taking us to a subject of cultural and different contextual touches. I know families who never touch their babies because the maids touch their babies. Mm. And the relationship between the maids and the child are very, very much different from that and the parents. In their signs of distress, this is a good example. If you go into a local pediatrician's clinic, you will see mothers walk in all dressed prim and proper and register the baby's name. But the baby who's distressed is being hugged and touched and cuddled by the maid who's walking in behind. Now, that kind of touch is sending different messages. But when you're talking about the skin to skin, who bathes the baby? Who plays with the baby when the baby is naked in the water? I mean, this is very early developmental stages. In different cultures, in different warmth, the Eskimo, how many layers of skin? How many layers of cloth? How many polar bears do you have between the baby and you? That kind of stuff. And I encourage skin to skin as far as possible. And as soon as that bond is developed, then you will have the morals that set in and the values, judgments that set in. But otherwise, skin to skin, and if I use the phrase, the nakedness of touch, the pure nakedness of touch, being able to touch honestly, openly, and say, I like you, how are you? In fact, there are rules to being touched. These rules develop as we go along, but these rules are developed according to the situation.
Also culture.
Hey, there's touch right across culture, man. Yep. I mean, even in religion, there's so much touch, you know, call it the touch of God, the healing touch.
Yep.
The Greek word for touch, I've forgotten what word it is, but the Greek word for touch, the original word for touch means the surgeon.
Oh, really?
It's called a healing touch, the touch of healing. That's how the word touch came from. So touch is considered a healing element.
Mm. But there are some cultures or perhaps even some religions that kind of frown upon touch, let's say between genders, if you're unrelated or, you know. So how do we look at touch in that context while respecting those norms?
Oh, I love how Paul points at me. Be like, oh, you answer the hard one.
No, I'm just saying.
There's no touch involved there.
No, I think we all originate from the same crucible. I think there's no difference. Culture is man-made. It's man-deserved. It's society-made. It's circumstantially designed. And so there are reasons for culture and cultural norms and mores to define how we behave. So it's purely a touch. I think it becomes a personal choice when you become aware of it.
I just to answer like the question, your question was like, you know, how do you kind of like navigate that?
And also, are we saying that because those cultural norms are different, therefore the individuals within that culture are all deprived?
No, of course not, right? So that specific, you know, when you say I shouldn't be touching an other gender when we're not of a particular relationship. Mm. Of course, if that's the case, then, you know, you got to respect that, right? Because it may be that because you're so ingrained with this belief that if you kind of force touch, you experience more distress because you're like, you know, this is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this, even though, like, Paul says it's good.
Also.
But even though the science suggests it's good, you don't feel comfortable doing it, it's not going to be good, right? So it has to be within the right context as well. And I think more importantly... Perception comes in, right? So if you think about harassment, the definition of harassment is it's not whether you intend to harass. I mean, the harasser, right, intends to harass, but whether the perceiver actually perceives it as harassment.
Yes.
So perception is extremely important here as well. So you got to kind of understand what people are feeling and thinking, and also, again, not always about your intentions. So... even though, yes, touch is really good, it has to be done within a context that is mutually, you know, acceptable, with respect, and also in the right environment.
You know, you're true. I mean, as simple as my wife's name is Sarah. So if I'm holding Sarah's hand, say, in a familiar environment, she'll respond. Now, you might even get a kind of sensorial feedback as well. But in a strange environment, if I reach out and hold on to her hand, she's like, hey, not here, la. You know, it wasn't a romantic or sexual touch in any nature, but it was still just touch and reaching out. But it's very contextual. But these cultural issues, they all transgressed when we take a child from any culture, put them in hospital and say, this baby needs to be touched. Then this baby needs to be cuddled. And we know for a fact, there are studies to that effect that, you know, serotonin, cortisol, and all this. Your immune system is boosted when you are touched appropriately. It's called positive touch. And we teach that in medical school, how to touch and how to stand by an auntie, uncle, and say, hold the hand and say, how are you? And if you kind of move a finger and caress while you're touching, I mean, it becomes inappropriate, you know. But this, it actually boosts the immune system. The brain is processing it. The whole body is processing it.
All right. We'll go for a break and come back to look at this some more. I've got so many questions. I'm speaking today to clinical psychologist Paul Jamunathan and social psychologist Dr. Goh Pei Hua. A very interesting conversation about touch. Things like affiliative touch, being able to communicate your emotions and, you know, intentions through touch, perception as well of touch, you know. So we're really going beyond a very narrow definition of touch in our discussion today. So we'll come back and continue that on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my guests today, clinical psychologist Paul Jamunathan and social psychologist Dr. Goh Pei Hua. We are discussing touch, how important it is in our relationships and our connections with others, which pathways in our brain does it fire up, and how it helps us to understand our environment, feel emotions. And like I said earlier, it comes back to connections with people, because a lot of our discussion is also about touch with others. And, you know, we talked a lot about infants, newborns, babies being held by their caregivers, especially when they're distressed, how they are comforted. It all comes back to touch. To do that for babies. Now, touch deprivation or the lack of touch. Firstly, how do we know when we are deprived of touch? Because we also talked about the context in which touch occurs. We talked about how it needs to be a personal choice, whether somebody is comfortable with touch or not, especially within the cultural norms that they live in. How do we know that somebody could be deprived of touch? And how do we understand the consequences of that?
Yeah, to my knowledge, I haven't come across a specific measure of touch deprivation.
There is one test, which is not a highly validated test.
It's the Paul Jambunathan.
No. It's been used in universities and all
of
that.
Yeah.
But it's a self-observation, self-perception report test saying, do you feel you've been touched enough? The kinds of touch, this kind of touch, that kind of touch. But there is no, you're right, there's no clinically relevant tool so far.
How do we, use yardsticks or benchmarks to understand this? I mean, I could feel because of my personal preferences that I don't need very much touch. Is it a clinical observation? You know, does somebody else tell me?
Depends on your developmental stage. If you're able to voice that, you know, comparatively, emotionally, if you can say, I have been hugged before, it's been a long time since I've been hugged. Or my wife doesn't hug me anymore. Or my friends don't touch me anymore. And
so
now COVID has changed the rules.
Mm.
There is some relevance there, some comparative relative issue there that we can talk about. But what we know clinically, that's where it's based. It's purely based subjectively and clinically, and there are anecdotal papers to that effect that suggest that all we know is that when someone is touched, if you study that person and say, this is the normal lifestyle, they have medicines in the morning, physio in the afternoon, this and this and then that. But when they are touched, they respond differently. When you take vitamin C, your body seems to be perking up. When there's music, you seem to be doing better. Then we realize that, hey, touch actually adds some flavor. Mm. And then we realize the more you touch or touch differently, touch seems to work. So it's kind of I don't know how you phrase that psychologically, but it's the needs met that proves the absence.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, right? So we may have different baselines. So really, again, going back to you said my favorite word, relative, earlier, it really is relative to what you are comfortable with and what you're used to. But of course, there are also cases where, you know, you may think you don't need touch, but somehow throughout, you know, as you grow older, you realize, actually, you know, I don't really know how to touch. I don't really know how to receive touch. And I feel very uncomfortable with touch.
Hey, Dr. Go, you know, you just opened a whole area which is highly scientifically explored now.
Yeah.
The aging population, we're getting robots to touch them. We have pet therapy. We are getting dogs and cats to come and touch older people and they feel better at the end of the day and they report such.
And is that connected with loneliness?
Yeah, of course. It's all associated, like Pei said earlier, it goes to so many other parts of the mind, not just the brain, that gives you this composite value of self and appreciation or being included or being relevant.
Mm. So that relative perception of whether you have enough or insufficient touch. Clinically, Paul, do people only come to that realization perhaps when they seek help or when they have distress that is manifested in other ways?
Okay, I speak from my clinic, okay, and my clinical experience by the bedside and things. I hardly ever walk into a bedside and tell the students, hey, listen, you know, I think this patient needs touch. This is not the Dr. House theory on TV kind of say, let's try touch therapy. No. I mean, this, in addition to everything else, we realize that when you held this lady's hand, we noticed that her pupils dilated, or you know, she smiled, she was averse, or she was happy, and then her answers changed. Hey, if you make these observations and then you plot this interpersonal interaction, you realize that hey, maybe touch works. Touch is medicine. Touch is medicine because it's interpersonal and it's social. It's such a lovely thing.
Mm. Pei, what has the research shown about the effects of touch deprivation? And I would imagine perhaps the pandemic has kind of surfaced a lot more of it.
I actually don't know a lot about touch deprivation during the pandemic, but we definitely have this deprivation, right, because of social distancing, you know. But it's hard to say, right, that people are worse off during the pandemic because they didn't get enough touch than before the pandemic, because there's so many other factors that come into play. So it's extremely difficult to just point it to that.
People may have been worse during the pandemic because of many other factors.
Many other factors.
Well,
and it's not just no touch during pandemic. different kind of touch. If you take it from a scale of zero to absolute touch, there's so many. It's not just whether you're touched and how often you're touched, but what kind of touch. Or don't touch me. You're in my space. Stay away. There's so many different aspects of touch that happened during this kind of episode called a pandemic, which has only just helped to show up our weaknesses. But it's happening every day. There's a pandemic in people's homes every day. It's about quarreling, angry, you got bad grades, I'm not going to touch you. Or come here, I'm going to slap you, which is a different kind of touch. And then the way you throw or push someone or push someone aside, or you touch another child as opposed to not touching another child. This is relative touching.
Mm. All right. But generally, what do we know about the effects of being deprived of touch?
Yeah. So before we know the effects of being deprived of touch, we should know what exactly touch does to us, right? So we've talked about how touch can convey a lot of information. In fact, touch is a way that we understand our environment and also how we feel, right? So when we get touched, we feel love, actually, right? So oxytocin. So Paul mentioned a lot of happy hormones earlier, but one of the key ones that are associated to touch is oxytocin, the love hormone. And we can see that in, you know, when it comes to like developing children and everything. But if I want to take all the science away and I kind of like look at my own personal experience, I was reflecting on this, right? And I realized that I don't really remember a lot of touching from my parents as a child, right? So yes, they would probably, I don't know, wash my hair or like, you know, help me.
It's functional.
You know, functional stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So, but if I really think about growing up, did my parents like, you know, hug me a lot? I guess it's the Asian culture. Correct. We don't get a lot of hugs. And it's okay, right? It's okay. It's just a cultural thing. But what happens later on is like, you know, I don't know if you want to call this touch deprivation because it sounds a bit like
But harsh. How it forms you.
But how it forms you is as I grew up, I didn't really know how to touch people. So I tend to, you know, and we are trained also to sit, you know, in a way that, you know, put your hands down or even when you stand, you put your hands at the side or behind you. So when I was growing up, and some people have friends that are a bit more touchier, a bit touchier than others. Yeah. I didn't have friends like that, you know. My friend groups, we were like, okay, we're
in from similar.
Exactly. Similar cultural background. Yeah. So when I really, really learned about touch was when I got into an intimate relationship. So like when I got into romantic relationships, when I started dating, right? And then I learned about, oh yeah, touch is love. You know, you can do a lot of things with touch. You can convey a lot of warmth with touch. And slowly then I realized, okay, I haven't really been doing a lot of this with people that I love, like my parents. Mm. And only as an adult and sadly, like through psychology, being a nerd and learning about what touch does for relationships, I started to implement that with my family, right? So my parents at first were like, what? Mm. What is she okay? You know? But of course, I did it gradually. I started with like, you know, playing around because my parents are quite playful. So I would like, you know, hug my mom and just to annoy her. And that, because funnily, that's the more acceptable kind of touch, you know, rather than hugging her and saying, I love you, mom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because don't go there. That's too intense, right?
Too intense. Too deep.
Yeah, so it started off with that. And then sometimes I would, you know, my parents are sitting down, would just give them a light massage or like also playfully be like, hey, sit up straight. You don't want to be Quasimodo, right? That's more acceptable than me being loving and rubbing my parents. Mm. But you can see that that in some way can be an effect of, I'm putting like, you know, little quotation marks here, touch deprivation, right? Mm. You don't really know how to deal with touch when it's given to you and you don't really know how to appreciate it and you need to do it slowly, right? Mm. So,
and in a way that's acceptable
exactly,
for the other person.
Exactly, yeah.
The phrase you just used when you don't know it till it's not there,
yes,
basically. And in my clientele, where touch is a very big thing because they feel lonely, they feel rejected, they feel dejected, they feel devalued, they're not relevant anymore. And it's very hard to convince and say, listen, when was the touch, last time someone gave you a hug? When was the last time you gave someone? And this doesn't come in the first session. Mm. you kind of do away with all the other superficial, the presumed superficial stuff. But then you also notice people who simulate touch. Instead of touching one another or touching another human being, they have self-touch. I take long baths. Mm. This is in the literature. You know, I want the human warmth temperature around me. I want a warm blanket tight around me. That's touch, you also know. And I want a pet around me. I sleep with my pet. Mm. So there is that kind of touch, the self-touch, touching other people, and simulated touch. So when you notice people have a lot of simulated touch, you're realizing, hey, this person could be touch-starved, touch-deprived. Mm. It doesn't mean you walk in there and say, hello, you're starched, you know, you are too much.
You have to look at the proxies.
No, you can't, yes. Mm. Yeah, but you've got to realize that touch is part of the normal diet, and sometimes it is deficient.
Mm. But Pei, what you said about, you know, just not knowing how to touch others could be an effect of, and we are saying this very loosely, touch deprivation.
Yeah, yeah.
But from the literature, touch deprivation itself is a thing. You talked about, you know, it's linked to higher prevalence of mental issues and things like that later in life. How has that connection been made? It seems so, you know, far-fetched in a way.
Let me ask her another question to help her answer the question. Okay. Where did you first learn to touch? Where did you first feel touched or learn to touch? That's a developmental question. I learned to touch from my primary environment. Whoever my primary environment was, when I learned what touch was or what touch meant. Now, if you can figure out how that happened, was it a slap? Was it deprivation? Was it being shut away in an emotional fridge? Then she learns how to define touch. But it was always hugging and cuddling and playing together and then, you know, bathing together as children in acceptable situations. And then roughhousing and wrestling with your siblings and all that. If that touch was there, then it becomes part of the norm. So the answer to the question lies in your developmental stages of touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you associate as
so
touch?
I asked the question, I didn't get paid to answer.
I know, right? I guess one of the things that came to my mind when you were talking about that was the attachment theory. So basically, we learn how to form attachments through, you know, our attachments in our early years, right? So on the one hand, I could see touch as a communication tool, right? That has been able to tell me as a child that there is support, there is a loving figure that's available to you. Like, I'll touch you to tell you I'm here, right? And also that there is someone that is accepting of you. So the availability and acceptance. And that is something that is extremely important as us human beings, because at the core, we are built to want to connect. There is this immense need to belong with everyone.
Yeah, right? It's part of the civility issue.
Exactly.
So if a person were to think back and think about what kinds of touch they associate with, you know, attachments in their lives, what if they only remember bad touches, negative, like slaps, like you said, all right? Or seeing your siblings being touched more and you being neglected. What does that do to a person?
That is an extremely good question. That is within Paul's realm.
I'm going to have to go back to my cooking skills, man. If you've been having too much salt all your life and you've forgotten what sugar is, I'm going to give you and help you have some more sugar. I'll help you decipher what's the difference between the sugar and the salt, what's good and bad, given your context, given your culture, and help you develop an appreciation for sugar or good touch. And challenge yourself to complete yourself or redefine yourself, saying, I am a human being and the largest organ in my body is my skin and I'm not using it. You know, I'm using it as a shield. And I'm not using it to communicate and make the best of myself. Yeah, so I go back to things like that, when identifying what you have, don't have, and introduce you therapeutically, I mean, or systematically to good touch. But solving the issue of bad touch is not easy. I mean, you could be a rape victim.
Mm-hmm.
You could be a murder attempt victim. You could be a no-touch victim who doesn't even know what touch is. So you need to be very careful how you approach that.
Mm. How do we look at consent within that then?
I think, you know, with consent, the best way is to ask.
Ask?
Yeah. I mean, okay, so what I would do is, like, because I do touch sometimes as part of, like, communication, right? So when I'm talking to someone and I want to tell them that, okay, I'm interested in what you have to say and I want to show them some warmth, I would likely just kind of, like, tap them. But I don't go straight to, like, very intimate zones. There is this rule, right, that you need to be, like, away, you know, so you don't go straight into their close zone, but you can just gently kind of tap and you see how they respond to it. If they kind of pull back a bit or they, you know, show a face or they don't do it back to you, stop doing it. Mm. But I was also thinking about my relationship with touch and I wonder, you know, with you guys as well, right? How's your relationship with touch? Like if you think of the word touch, think of your childhood, right? Where have you seen that word, touch?
In the supermarket, in the shops. Don't touch.
Oh my gosh,
exactly.
Yes.
Don't touch. Don't touch me. Don't touch.
Or like if broken, considered sold, you know?
And every parent's refrain, which I do myself, don't touch anything, it might break.
Exactly. So...
Or you might spoil it.
So what does that do to you as an adult? Mm. Don't touch your friend. You may spoil her, you know? But see, that's like one of those things that, you know, we don't really think about, right?
We're almost removing that one sense from a person's experience,
exactly.
Right?
Very well put. Yeah, true.
So then, you know, do we teach? Is this something we teach kids to do, right? Because we seem to be teaching the reverse in a way. Don't. And I know some kids they struggle with sensory processing issues as well, where, you know, the sensory input overloads them, right? And that's a whole other topic maybe or a whole other challenge. Perhaps let's just bring it back to a general sense of, you know, we're looking at trying to have a better balance of touch in our lives. And we come back to children again, the developmental and formative stage. What can we be teaching our kids?
I would start off by teaching them how to become more sensitive, not hyper, how to become more sensitive and to appreciate their different senses and how these senses integrate into your responsiveness towards other people. We taste other people? Yes, when you hug and kiss someone on the cheek, that you're tasting. What I'm saying is we go through a whole multi-sensorial experience when we interact with other people, depending on how close they are in your circle. So if I had a curriculum to develop, I would develop a sensorial curriculum where we learn how to put this in context, take it home. Okay, now we're running a school now and we've got so many people from different cultures. Take it home, put it in context, discuss it with your parents, and come back and talk about it. And as you grow, you'll think about it differently. And if I'm focusing on touch, then I would build, I'll build an interactive, deliberate parenting curriculum on how to deal with touch at home. And it's beneficial, mutually beneficial for the primary caregivers and for the child. That's what I would take that approach.
Mm. I would take that and then add on also the consent bit. I've seen, like, you know, parents now trying, you know, instead of just like when a child is in distress, just going and hugging them or just doing something to them, they would say, "Can I give you a hug?"
Oh,
and
wow.
Then let the child say yes or no. Mm. And then they proceed to do it. I think that's a really nice approach.
Because it models.
Exactly.
How consent can be, you know, asked for and given, right?
And modeling is the core. Yeah. I think that's how we learn as a child. You can tell me something.
Yeah.
I'll be like, okay, sure.
It doesn't make sense.
I see how you're doing something. Yeah. I'm going to do it because you're my role model. I love you. I want to be like you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts to wrap up, Paul?
Well, for me, touch is such an important thing. It's part of my personality. I'm a very tactile person. But I hope I constantly practice appropriate touching. I'd like to advise any of you who is in a situation to touch and touch appropriately, touch now. Don't wait, it's too late, because I've seen people hugging dead bodies without having touched them long enough throughout their lives. And then you're touching a cold, unresponsive bit of tissue. No more spirit, no more soul, gone. So touch now when there's responsive touching. And then you can meet the challenges there. So touch when you can touch. but appropriately, please.
Okay.
Well, for me, I think one of the things I want to talk about is when touch is not possible, how can you still reap the benefits of touch? So this is where my nerd part comes in. I read a study. So this was a study that was done as an experiment, right? So they got people to imagine being touched as a form of support. So one is touch support, one is verbal support. And others are just like, you know, neutral stuff like, oh, imagine a printer and tell me how it works. So basically what the experimenters did was they got like different groups of participants, put them in these different categories, right? One of them, they said, okay, can you please write 5 minutes about a situation where you receive some touch support from a partner? And then another group was like, oh, verbal support. Mm-hmm. Also 5 minutes, write that down. Another one was like, oh, tell me how a printer looks like and how it functions. Right, so that's the control, right?
Yeah.
So after this, they put them through like some stressful situations, right? So one of them was they put them through like a typical stress task where, you know, you ask them to present something to the public where you feel evaluated, and then you did like really stressful math task. And what they found was this imagined touch was already helpful. So people felt less stressed out, and people felt just generally more at ease as compared to like the other conditions.
Even the verbal support.
Even the verbal support, exactly. Mm. So sometimes, you know, you're tempted to think that, okay, if I can't touch you to support you, I can verbally support you, because we can convey intimacy through, you know, verbal communication as well. But if all this is not possible, just simply imagining that you're being hugged by someone can be helpful. Of course, not as effective as the real thing, but something like that can be really effective. So this is shown experimentally, which means that it works, right?
Yeah, it's evidence.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, if in you're ever in a situation where you cannot get access to touch, just imagine you're being touched or
simulated.
Take a hot bath. That's like the best.
All right. Thank you so much. That was a conversation about touch. I hope you found it as interesting as I did. We really kind of went everywhere, didn't we? But at the end of the day, we're talking about something that is so fundamental to our daily lives. It's within reach, pardon the pun again. I've been speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan and social psychologist Dr. Goh Pei Hua. This has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.